Hey folks, welcome to today's podcast. A very interesting interview today with P.F. Sloan, and one that got folks commenting on the playlist for the program in large numbers. I got a lot of emails, Facebooks, a few phone calls. People really polarized by P.F. Sloan's comments and his story, and well, you'll hear it. It's all coming up here. Just wrote some amazing music. I played over an hour of his music in the program. You can hear the whole thing over at wfmu.org/Michael. But here is my interview with the very interesting, very talented, very unusual P.F. Sloan.
Can't live a life and expect to die with a soul in paradise. You know you gotta pay the price like you oughta. Blood's thicker than water, and the sins of a family fall on the daughter. All the sins of a family fall on the daughter.
Well, P.F. Sloan, welcome to WFMU. We're so pleased to have you. You've got a new book out called What Exactly the Matter With Me, a autobiography, and a new record out called My Beethoven, 9 original songs based on the real life of Beethoven. But it all started, I think, in New York City. You were born in New York City before. I mean, you're so closely associated with California, but you were born in New York City, and your dad, I think, was a pharmacist and moved you guys out there 1957. Does New York City, was it in your blood at that young an age at all?
Yes, it was. Yeah, and New Jersey as well, Union City. Used to go there every Sunday for family dinners. So yeah, the East, New York and New Jersey really are in my blood.
So was it a little culture shock moving to West Hollywood?
It was a long time ago to remember it. It was a new start. You know, I was one of those kind of kids in school that got under the teacher's nerves. So it felt like a new start more than a culture shock.
Was there music in your house? Were your folks record buyers, radio listeners?
No, surprisingly not. No, there really wasn't any indication that there was any music in the family there at all.
So where did you get the idea? Where did you get the love of pop music and decide that might be something you're interested in? How young were you?
I must have been about 6. My parents entered me in a New York State singing contest when I was 6 years old, and I came in 2nd place singing a song, Me and My Teddy Bear.
And so your dad bought you a guitar at some point, and I don't know if this happened when he bought you the guitar, but you ran into Elvis Presley at a Hollywood music store. Is that correct?
That is correct. I met him when I was 12, and he taught me how to play Love Me Tender on the guitar, and really taught me about love. 6 months later, I naturally auditioned for an all-black record label called Aladdin Records and got signed to them.
Yeah. I'm sorry, you ran to Elvis in the store, and he taught you in the store that song?
Yes. Yes, he was upstairs having his guitar fixed, and I was downstairs asking the man behind the counter, what do I play? How can I play these 5 other strings? I only knew how to play on a 1-string broken ukulele.
Was he a mind-blowing kind of a guy? I mean, he seems like such a huge force of personality. Was he like that back then?
Yes, and I didn't know such things. Hadn't really experienced anything like love. It was less about celebrity. I mean, I realized who he was immediately because my sister and my mother were both in love with him. But the amount of love that he poured out on me just opened up some sort of love center inside myself and a love for music.
How interesting. It's kind of the fulcrum for starting you on your way. Do you think he saw something in you that made him want to touch you in some way?
Who knows? But, you know, I'm an Elvis file, and I love to hear stories from anybody who's met him. And it seems to be pretty consistent that he just poured out his love on everyone.
Amazing. So, like you said, you get signed at age 12 to Aladdin, which, like you said, it's in its last days. It's been an all R&B label pretty much, and I guess they're trying to sort of to stay with it and do some sort of more rock and roll stuff. So you made a few singles, Aladdin and the Mart label. My favorite of those, I think, is probably She's My Girl, which is kind of like a Richie Valens, Chris Montez meets Elvis sort of thing. How did that happen, and who's playing on those early records?
Yeah, that was really something. I think it was Bill Pittman on Dano Electric Bass, and I think he played on the original Richie Valens record. I'm not entirely sure about that. I'm trying to remember the drummer's name. He had a very famous hit called Teen Beat, Sandy Nelson.
Oh, yeah.
And I was in love with Richie Valens. So yeah, it was Richie Valens meets Elvis.
And what were the expectations for those very, very early records?
For the label or for myself?
For either, for both.
Well, for the label, you know, they had Jen and Arnie. They had Bruce and Terry. They had a young, I'm trying to remember his name, who was one of the co-founders of Bread. They had Mel Carter. They were expecting big things. They seemed to me a magnet for, which is curious because Jan and Dean being on the Arwen record label, which was Mark Records, and Bruce and Terry, I would wind up following them. Unbeknownst to me, within a few years, I'd be working with Bruce and Terry and Jan and Dean.
Yeah, it's funny how small a world it becomes. By 1961, you're working as a staff writer at Screen Gems. How did you make that move? And you're still so, so young. How did it happen?
Persistence. just absolute persistence. I would go every day from junior high school. I would go over to Screen Gems Music and sit on the couch, and I had a 150-pound tape recorder with me with 150 songs, and I would sit there every day, and they would just walk around me like I became a piece of furniture there. You know, it took about 6 months, but eventually they invited me in to listen to the songs that I'd written, and one of the executives from Alden Music from New York was there, and he decided to sign me for $10 a week.
And were those early songs, are some of them songs we know, or were they all sort of things that you...
Well, nothing goes to waste. That's what I've learned in music. Nothing goes to waste. A melody, a song idea, a rhyme couplet. I must have written about 185 songs that were on the tape by the time I was 15. Yeah, some of those became Kick That Little Foot, Sally Ann, and Unless You Care by Jerry Black. But nothing goes to waste with musicians.
So when you were writing these songs, was it in your head, this one might be good for Bobby Darin, or this might be good for Frank Sinatra, or for, you know, the Coasters or whatever? Or were you just writing the songs from you to the guitar?
Well, there were two things. One was songs that I would write on my own at 15 or 16, and I would say to the bosses, like a song like Kick the Little Foot, Sally Ann, I said, you know, I wrote this for Harry Belafonte. So they would send it to Harry Belafonte. But basically, my job was to, they would come in the morning and put a list of songs, you know, the Drifters, Leslie Gore, whoever, you know, she needs a follow-up, you know, so write a song almost exactly like the hit she had, but a little bit different. So you begin to learn the craft, and you begin to really study the lyrics, and you know the artist, and you begin to learn the craft of it. And, you know, it's a great place to start by mimicking everyone who's ever written a song.
So you're working, churning out these songs. And at some point, I think you meet Steve Barry, who becomes your partner for quite a while. How old were you when you met him? And was it somebody's idea that you guys would work together?
Well, it was. I was 16. I think he was 21 or 22. He was married. He was working at a record store in Los Angeles, and he had begun working with one of the girls from the Teddy Bears. They had made a record, and he went up to Screen Gems to get a record deal. They didn't want to buy the record, but they signed him as a writer, and they threw him into my little cubbyhole, and they said, "You two write together." Problem was that Steve didn't know how to write music. He couldn't play an instrument, but none of the magic really could have happened without him being there for me.
How very. So you say you're making $10 a week, and I'm not sure exactly how publishing worked back then or really how it works now, and I'm sure the listeners would love to know. So how did income work at that point? If you were making records that were getting released, did you get paid per record or a bonus or anything like that, or were you getting your BMI money or mechanical royalties? How did it work?
Well, being 16 years old, everything goes to court. So all the money was held in trust, and I wasn't allowed to touch it till I'm 21.
Okay, so you and Steve Barry begin a huge role, and one of the things that you guys do, besides writing lots and lots of songs, is you start recording under different names, group names, duo names, Philip and Steven, the Rally Packs, the Wildcats, the Street Cleaners, the Rincon Surfside Band, the Lifeguards. What was the culture that allowed that to happen? Was it just, let's see if we can get a hit by just throwing a lot out there?
You have to try and wrap your head around this. This wasn't about hits. This was simply about a small little publishing West Coast company trying to sell masters. In other words, they weren't trying to get a hit. They were just trying to sell the master for a specific amount of money. And then that was it. They would then sell me as, you know, all these different groups. And, you know, they were able to sell me to all these different labels and get money up front, which the company got. And that's as far as it went.
So the money-making, the business plan here was just to have you record, and then they would sell those masters and keep the fee and have you just do that as much as possible, almost in a disposable way?
Yes, exactly.
And so were you using a studio owned by Screen Gems?
Well, you know, we started working at Western Recorders, where basically all the later in 64, 65, later all the hits were coming out of Western Recorders. But basically, these were very inexpensive records. I played all the instruments, and it was just, you know, $15 an hour, you know, for studio costs. You know, I would get Darlene Love to sing background for me for $15. Glenn Campbell, you know, all the Wrecking Crew, Hal Blaine, Joe Osborne, you know, all working for $15 an hour.
Were those demo rates, or how did you finagle that?
Exactly, demo rates. Yeah, they never did anything union.
It sounds like it must have been a super exciting time. I mean, you're so young at this point. Did it seem unusual to you, or no?
No. I was in love with learning the craft. Obviously, you know, you can't listen to Little Richard's records or Elvis's early records or Chuck Berry's records without it sort of rearranging your DNA. I mean, to be honest with you, those records were so exciting that the idea of actually coming up with something original that exciting was the goal.
That's still the goal, I think, you know.
Yes.
It should be, yeah. So soon after, at this point, Lou Adler, who also works at that company, starts using you for Jan and Dean, who he manages, and for some other things, and you get that hit, Kick That Little Foot, Sally Ann, and you start arranging, playing on some of those big Jan and Dean hits, and I believe that's you singing the falsetto part on The Little Old Lady from Pasadena, is that right?
Yes, that is right. I actually did all the falsettos after Honolulu Lulu, all the Jan and Dean hits. And then Steve, Barry, and I would be singing background as the Fantastic Baggies. You know, it got to a point later in Jan's career that Jan would actually have me sing his part as well.
That's nice work, if you can get it, yeah. Wow. Okay, you mentioned the Fantastic Baggies. This was sort of a surf group that was really, again, just you and Steve, very much in the Beach Boys thing. How huge were the Beach Boys at that point? And again, was this your idea, or did somebody say, you need to start a surf band?
The Beach Boys were just beginning to catch fire, but Jan and Dean were the big stars. They had Linda, Jan and Dean take Linda surfing, then they had Surf City. So the Beach Boys were just beginning to happen. I started writing surf songs, and again, the record label said, we could make money just by selling them as another group to Imperial. But what happened was that the Fantastic Baggies actually caught fire with Tell 'Em I'm Surfing and Summer Means Fun. So, the label didn't want us to become record stars, so they had to get rid of the Fantastic Baggies, but kept us, singing background for Jan and Dean.
Mm. Some of the Fantastic Baggies records are just really fun. Did you, at that point, was there sort of a struggle of whether or not to become an artist or to stay behind the scenes for you?
I had wanted to be a recording artist. I mean, remember, I started recording at 13 for Aladdin. So, I had the dream of going out and performing, but the label found that, I was a much more important property, just being a songwriter and producer. So they kept me away from that as much as they could until the birth of P.F. Sloan happened.
Hmm. So the next few years, you guys have tons of hits and tons of songs on records and tons of covers of the hits. You become really a sensation in that mid-1960s period. Eve of Destruction gets written, Sins of the Family, You Baby for the Turtles, Must to Avoid for Hermans, Take Me for What I'm Worth, The Searchers, Secret Agent Man for Johnny Rivers, et cetera, et cetera. And like I said, Eve of Destruction, which is a number one hit. Tell me what your daily routine was like. What was your writing routine? How did you pump out so many songs? I mean, it's really mind-boggling, because when you look at the dates that these are all released in, it's not a long period.
It's a 3-year period of around 30 chart records and 250 songs recorded. It wasn't until the birth of P.F. Sloan, where Steve, Barry, and I were, I was writing a lot of these songs by myself, Kick That Little Foot and Unless You Care, and some of the songs Steve and I would write together. But it wasn't until P.F. Sloan came that happened one night. This consciousness came into me, and I wrote 5 songs one night, Eve of Destruction, Sins of the Family, Take Me for What I'm Worth, etc., etc. I played them for the head of the company, and they threw them in the wastebasket. They said, these are not songs that we can publish. So all of a sudden there was a split in my life. I wanted to write this kind of lyric and music, but I still had to be writing with Steve Barry, which was pop, and I love pop. I love all kinds of music. But when Eve of Destruction actually took off, and it caused a riff in the company, because they didn't want P.F. Sloan to become a star, and at the same time, his songwriting and his music was selling so much that they didn't know what to do. So it became a weird situation.
Well, tell me again about sort of the birth of P.F. Sloan. You were this guy writing, in some cases, novelty records or follow-up records, and then you had an awakening to write a different kind of song. I mean, what was the physical sensation that happened to you?
I was born. I felt as if something magical had happened, and I remember waking my mother up at 3 o'clock in the morning, wanting to read her the lyrics to Eve of Destruction and Sins of a Family, saying, "Mom, something wonderful has happened." And he said, "You'll wake your father up, go back to bed." So, you know, basically that kind of was the story. Shh, you know, don't mention P.S. Sloan.
From me, and you're 19 years old at this time. I mean, stardom is hard for mature people. Were you, you know, how were you handling it?
As best I could. I mean, there wasn't much support. It sort of happened all on its own. I mean, Eve of Destruction was not the A side of the record. It was the B side. The A side was called What's Exactly the Matter with Me? And it just so happened that the B-side took off. The record label was unhappy about it because they were getting death threats because of the lyrical content. The song was banned all over the world. And so these three partners who wanted to make money in the record business are now the victims, now being, you know, getting death threats against them. So, you know, they wanted to get rid of Barry McGuire, and they needed to get rid of P.F. Sloan. But P.F. Sloan was writing so many songs, and they were becoming hits. You know, they just didn't know what to do, but they didn't like it. They didn't like this hippie music.
Very interesting. I mean, you do hear sort of stories about, especially in the earliest days of rock and roll, where, you know, many of the bigger labels sort of sat out the beginning of rock and roll, and that's why so many indies were able to get to score hits, because they thought it would be some sort of passing thing. And then by the time they sort of got in, you know, Mitch Miller didn't know a thing about rock and roll or these guys who were heading these labels. And it's that's why this sort of early time is so interesting. And I think partly why a 19-year-old guy could, you know, have such success, because the older guys just didn't know what was going on. Was there some palpable feeling of that?
Yeah, Michael, you hit the nail right on the head. I mean, here's an interesting story that most people don't know about. But after the first three number ones by the Beatles, EMI put them up for sale. You know, they thought nobody has more than three number one records. I mean, Nat King Cole on Capitol had, you know, a number one record, Frank Sinatra. So they tried to sell the Beatles to Columbia and to RCA for $50,000, and they all turned them down.
Yeah.
I mean, nobody, as you're saying, nobody in the music business understood pop music at all, and they expected it to die.
Yeah, it's sort of really the history of America in some ways. You know, it's so interesting. So tell me, during the same time, you're playing a lot of sessions. You're playing on a lot of those records we mentioned. You know, the Turtles and all those Johnny Rivers, those records. Tell me about working with those session guys. I think you play the guitar, that famous guitar in the intro of California Dreamin'. Did the session guys, like you mentioned, Hal Blaine and Carole Kaye, Tommy Tedesco, did those folks welcome a young kid like you who could not read sheet music, or how did they let you into that little select group?
They actually didn't. It was Jack Nietzsche, the great arranger. When I had written Kick the Littlefoot Sally Ann, and Jack Nietzsche told the Wrecking Crew, he had the Wrecking Crew in a circle, and he put me in the center of the circle with my guitar, and he told all the musicians, I want you to follow this 16-year-old kid. And they looked at him like he was crazy, and they, you know, all got up and walked out. And Jack told them, look, unless you do what I say, you'll never work for Phil Spector again. So, you know, they bit the bullet, and, you know, they actually thought that I might have had something. You know, I was a very enthusiastic guitar player. So, you know, slowly they began to accept me, but you have to understand that those guys were earning their living, and they thought I might be taking, you know, food away from their table. But I was also a record producer at 17, so I was hiring these guys, and I began to know them. And you know, there's nothing like hanging around a musician to hear the greatest jokes in the world. And, I realized then, you know, I really want to be a musician. I want to know what it feels like to be lighthearted and have a beautiful spirit. So I learned a lot from these great musicians.
Tell me about the writing sessions and how disciplined were you guys? How many hours a day did you write songs? Because there's so many songs. Was it tough labor, or was it just something that was flowing out of you?
Well, Steve was married and had a child, and he was working 8 hours a day at a record store on Fairfax Boulevard. So I would be able to get him at my house, you know, for an hour a day. And, you know, we would come up with the song title, and we would write two lines, and then Steve would have to go to back to work, and then I would finish the song up.
And that's literally how many, many of those songs were written, just that exact way. Steve would sort of help you get the inspiration, get the ball rolling, and then you would do the other 80% or whatever?
Yeah. Steve was very, like a song like Where Were You When I Needed You for the Grassroots, you know, Steve came up with the title for that. And then I would just, you know, write the lyric and write the music.
And did you feel that was a fair distribution of labor at that point, or?
I was a young kid, and I really thought that Steve was, you know, my older brother. And, you know, basically Steve wanted, you know, 50% of everything that I wrote as P.F. Sloan, which I didn't really think was fair, but, you know, he wound up getting that. But, you know, we were young. We didn't think we were going to succeed. I was in love with music. I wanted Steve to be successful. You know, I didn't question it until everything collapsed.
So 1965, you sort of start a solo career, or P.F. Sloan starts a solo career, and it's kind of, the records are great. They're some of my favorites. It's kind of a folk rock, but with a real pop feel in it too, and it's kind of just a perfect, I think, mid-60s situation, you know, the lyrics and the feel of the songs and the way you sing them, the performances, really, I think, do a great job representing what was happening in the mid-60s. Songs of Our Times, 1965, Sins of the Family, Take Me for What I'm Worth, I'd Have to Be Out of My Mind, What Am I Doing Here With You, these are all great sort of wry songs that sort of comment a little bit about what's going on. Was there sort of a plan to sort of do folk rock, or was that just what was happening inside you?
No, it was really happening inside me. And the idea, the P.F. Sloan first album was done in about 4 days. It was basically a demo album, a songwriter's demo album. When Sins of a Family got mistakenly released, and all of a sudden it started hitting the charts, the record label pulled it back. So, I mean, it hit the charts first week, I think, in the 70s, and Billboard called up and said it's going to number 40 next week, and they said, no, we're pulling the record. So they really want this P.F. Sloan artist to happen. They were trying to deal with him as a songwriter. They couldn't deal with me as a recording artist. You have to keep in mind that, you know, they were handling people like Johnny Rivers, Ann Margaret, and Jan and Dean, and they didn't understand this hippie music. And another thing you have to understand is that Bob Dylan wasn't really happening. You know, he wasn't selling albums. You know, so there really was no call for this.
Tell me about all these records are coming out, and some you're a part of the making of, and some you aren't. You know, there's Turtles Records and Hermits Records, and Mel Torme is covering your songs, and like you said, Ann Margaret, and all these different people. Is it ever a weird sensation to hear a record of your song that where someone does a great or a terrible job? Is that a weird thing?
It's a weird thing. You know, this may be a little bit broad to say, but any time a record producer recorded the song the way I demoed it, it became a hit. When they varied away from the way that I had envisioned it, it didn't become a hit.
You mentioned that the action in the early part of your career was in New York, and I think your rise is kind of coincides with the rise of L.A. as kind of the center of pop music, and it's no longer New York, and that sort of Tin Pan Alley model is, you know, is kind of ending, and you know, Los Angeles becomes the place, and the Wrecking Crew, you know, so many records are pouring out of there. Just the energy must have been amazing to be, because just to hear so many hit records. Did you get to a point where you heard where you could hear a song and know, yes, this one's going to be a hit?
Yeah, Michael, that's something that is mind-boggling. You know, I would go to a producer and he'd say, Phil, you know, you know, what songs do you have? And I'd say, look, I have to apologize. I said, this song will only go top 20. And he said, really? I said, yeah. He said, well, I'll take it then. And the song only went to like 21. I could tell when I'm writing it, and it's coming from a very deep, deep place. I mean, I could tell that that song is going to be a hit or not. I could tell by the amount of laziness within me. I mean, you know, when you're working 20 hours a day, I noticed that as a songwriter, I began to get a little bit lazy. In other words, the lyric on the second verse or the bridge wasn't as original and as good as it could be. I just sort of skimmed through it, and those were good songs, but they didn't become hits.
So you've got more solo records coming, more just amazing songs, and you guys start you and Steve start this group called the Grassroots. You cover this song "Let's Live for Today," which was a hit for a British group called the Rokes, I think, and it becomes a huge hit. And soon after that, the end of the '60s sort of becomes the end of P.F. Sloan. What happens? I've never sort of quite understood the story. You sort of break up with Steve Barry and with Lou Adler and with everybody. What happens?
Well, in the book, you know, I go into a lot of detail and try to make it as humorous as I can. But what it came down to, Michael, was greed, monstrous greed. I was earning millions of dollars for the company, and they resented the fact that they had to pay me for the work. So they basically pulled a Jackie Wilson, and that is, they pretty much put a gun to my head and said, you know, we're going to kill you and your family unless you sign away all your rights and give us all the rights to all of your songs from now until forever. And we want you out of town in 24 hours or we're going to kill you. And that was the end.
And this is what, 1967?
1967, yes.
But that sort of stops the money train cold there. I mean, it seems like obviously it's a strange move.
Yeah, I know. I mean, if you try and find the logic, here you have, let's say, I don't know, call it the golden goose.
Yeah.
And the golden goose has been laying 25 golden eggs, right? They're not thinking about the future. They just want the 25 golden eggs to themselves. So they decided to kill the golden goose.
And so you're saying this was a literal threat and you took it very seriously?
Oh, yes, yes. The head of the record label was from Chicago. And as I talk about it in the book, he showed me pictures of body parts all over the street. And he said, you know, we have a way of getting what we want. So I left Los Angeles and was forced to leave Los Angeles. And Steve Barry continued working at Dunhill. And I was forced to move back to New York, which I did, and began to live in Greenwich Village.
Why didn't they threaten Steve for his half of the stuff as well?
Well, you'll have to read the book about that, Michael. It's a little bit complicated, but when you read the book, you'll find out what happened. Basically, I was forced out and forced to sign away everything, and that's the way the play was supposed to be.
I mean, legally, how much can you sign away? Can you sign away your future mechanical royalties to everything?
Yes, everything, yes.
So if somebody uses, you know, one of your songs in a car commercial, you don't benefit at all?
That's correct.
That is unbelievable.
But Steve still gets paid.
Now I've got to go get the book, obviously, and figure this out. Do you still get your BMI money, I assume?
That they couldn't have me sign away.
Right, that's the one thing. But I assume that is enough to, I don't know, probably for my lifestyle, live a decent life. Was it enough to tide you over through the years?
No, not really. Believe it or not, back in those days, I was only earning about $4,000 a year from BMI.
Wow.
Well, so basically, I mean, I had to do odd jobs and, you know, began delivering beer, you know, and try to become a life insurance salesman. And, you know, eventually it got to be too much and I just broke down.
Yeah. So the idea of writing songs under a different name or starting over, that was not an option for you?
No.
These guys wouldn't?
No. No, the poet that was in me that became P.F. Sloan was something that I really believed in. I mean, I believed in P.F. Sloan as much as I believed in Elvis Presley and the Beatles and everyone else. I mean, I had to go follow that dream, you know, no matter where it was going to take me.
Okay, so you're living in New York. You're doing some opening act kind of stuff, but you're delivering beer and trying to get a new career going. And like you said, you just can't take it, which sounds like perhaps is the sane reaction to what had happened to you. So what, again, physically, what happened to you?
Well, you know, I did get signed to Atlantic Records from working in New York and released an album on ATCO. But I had a nervous breakdown during the making of it. I recorded it, believe it or not, at Sun Studios.
That's Measure of Pleasure, right? From 68?
Yeah. And, you know, that was a full circle thrill, you know, to have Elvis's original producer down there for the sessions and Tom Dowd, who produced Ray Charles and Aretha Franklin. And ATCO believed in me, but, you know, I just really couldn't live away from my family, and living in New York was a tough thing for me. And I just broke down. I developed all sorts of illnesses, some life-threatening, and went into a state of catatonia for 12 years.
Were you taking drugs at all? Was that part of your scene?
Well, you know, the beautiful thing was that, you know, up until this time, there was really no drug usage, you know. Not that I want to talk about the drugs, but Greenwich Village was a very dark place in 1968, you know, and you know, there was a lot of heavy drug usage going on there. And, you know, if you wanted to earn any credibility with the New York scene, you had to be doing some of those drugs. And I got involved in it, unfortunately. I was able to get off of it, but, you know, basically I'm just a very simple home guy, and you know, I just missed California and I missed my family, and I wasn't really, I didn't feel like I was cut out, you know, for this kind of lifestyle. So I just shut down for about 14 years.
So what did you do during those years? I mean, you really did disappear. Where were you?
Well, my, you know, Noel Paul Stuckey from Peter, Paul and Mary saved my life. He saw that I was dying and he called my parents up in 1970. And said, Mr. and Mrs. Sloan, you have to get your son home, but he doesn't want to leave. So they came, they flew to New York, and they took me home. And they took me back to my childhood house, and I stayed in bed in my bedroom for about 14 years.
I mean, did you watch television? Did you?
No, I was catatonic.
Were doctors brought in? I mean,
Yeah, I was diagnosed with severe hypoglycemia catatonia, but there was no cure for it.
And this is just a psychologically derived situation?
Well, organic as well, the hypoglycemia. They put me in a couple of mental institutions as well, but that didn't really work. We called it the vegetable garden.
So how did you snap out of this? I mean, how did that period end? I mean, it's horrifying.
You know, catatonia is an amazing thing. It's sort of like being in a coma, and yet you're aware of everything, but you can't remember anything. You know, it's like I'm aware that you're there, but I can't talk, and I can't remember anything that was just said. What happened was a holy man in India by the name of Sai Baba came to me in a dream. I had never heard of him, and he said, come to me and I will heal you. I tell about the story in the book, how it happened that I was able to get the money to go to India, and I did go to India, and he began to heal me. And within a few number of years, I was able to walk and talk and began writing songs again.
it was a struggle to get back. I mean, it's kind of a bigger than life story. In Catatonia, the man came to you in a dream, and he actually existed, and you found him.
Yes, and flew to India, and he came over to me and tapped me on the cheek and said, "You're a brave, brave boy," and he said, "I'm going to heal you," and he did. And
it's unbelievable. You've been making music, you know, on and off since then, and playing some shows and stuff. And you do have the new book out, What's Exactly the Matter with Me? And it sounds like just a must read. And a new record called My Beethoven. 9 original songs based on the real life of Beethoven. Now, Beethoven has not come into the story yet at all. Was he a huge influence on you?
Not at all. I had never really heard Beethoven. It just so happened, believe it or not, that I was contacted by him, and he asked me to find out why he tried to commit suicide. And that began an 18-year search. This was before the internet, so I had to go to the library. And I had to go to every library to find out the story of Beethoven. And then I realized that everything that I had been reading about Beethoven was a lie. It was all written by a guy by the name of Schindler, who was fired by Louis 6 months after he was working for him because he was stealing from him. So I began to learn how to play piano. I didn't know how to play piano. And I began listening to Glenn Gould. And I began to learn how to play piano, and eventually, after 18 years of learning how to compose for an orchestra and play piano, and the lyrics, which took so many years to write, because B.B. King told me once when I was a young kid, he said, "Philip," he said, "90% of what you think and what you write is bullshit." He said, "You have to peel away your soul to get a place that's away from your ego, to get to the spiritual center of your being, and that's where your true lyrics are." So that took a lot of years, and I recorded in this little home studio that I gradually built up over the years, and this miracle of My Beethoven came out. And the reason I'm calling it My Beethoven is because the elitists have hijacked Beethoven. Okay, Michael? You know, they get dressed up in tuxedos and they spend $300 for a ticket to go hear Beethoven. Well, you know, Ludwig, who was called Louis by the French, you know, he liked to play in bars. He was just a people person. And another thing about Louis which attracted me was that he was a folk singer. I bet you didn't know that. He always had a guitar with him, and he wrote over 400 folk songs.
Yeah, I've never heard that about Beethoven.
Nobody knows that about Louis.
Yeah.
He always played a guitar, and he wrote over 400 folk songs. He wrote Russian folk songs, Hungarian folk songs. Bobby Burns, the great poet, would send him lyric, and he would write the music to the Bobby Burns, and that would become a folk song. And the other thing that attracted me to Ludwig van Beethoven was he was always considered a Mozart wannabe. He was never really accepted on his own. And I was considered a Bob Dylan wannabe, so there was a lot to attract me to him. And basically, in the album, I'm writing his life story, but it's actually my own as well.
Fascinating. I did not know that you didn't play piano prior to this. That's kind of mind-boggling. So where do you live nowadays?
Well, I've been blessed with a Sai Baba when I had gone back to India a number of times. I asked him, because I was living in a one room apartment, surrounded by other people, and I couldn't really play music. And one day I asked him, you know, is there a house for me? And he said, yes, there is a house. And within 6 months, I was able to afford this house that I'm living in and working on the Beethoven project and the Sailover CD, which came out, I think, in 2007.
What do you say to people that have that just part of their life is not talking to Beethoven or to you know, getting answers from a bigger voice. How do you explain that to people?
It's all about love and beauty. I mean, the search in music for me is that I found something beautiful in Elvis Presley's voice. I found something beautiful in music, and I wanted to find that beauty within myself to write that. When I discovered Beethoven, I discovered the real heart and soul of beauty. And so I decided to make that my life's work, to discover and write the beauty that God gave me in my heart and soul. And whether I succeeded in that, time will tell. But I'd love to give Beethoven back to the people. You know, it's my Beethoven, not their Beethoven.
So what's next for you? Is there more projects like this in your head, or is there pop songs, or what's the next thing?
You know, I don't know. I'm in the process of touring with the book and with the album. It seems that the good Lord has me going out every 7-8 years. You know, I can't tell you why that is, but whenever I perform, you know, people are amazed, you know, that it's a great show, because I don't perform that often. So I'm just enjoying life and performing and, you know, and talking to you, Michael, about, you know, a really roller coaster ride of a life, you know.
Yeah, it's absolutely fascinating. Tell me, when you, I don't know, do you have an iPod? Do you listen to music on that?
I used to have an iPod. I don't listen to iPods anymore. And the MP3s are, you know, the MP3s sound really good through earbuds, but come on. I mean, now they're charging, you know, $300 for earbuds. You know, I mean, you're still only getting 7% of the actual sound.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I'd rather listen to vinyl if I can.
So what do you listen to when you feel like hearing some music? What makes you smile? What do you like?
Early Beatles, of course, Beethoven. Practically anything by Beethoven makes him smile, because being a musician, you know, if you're listening to a song, you know, you kind of go on hold because you know where it's going, you know, chord-wise. But with Beethoven, he makes these left turns and these right turns and these U-turns, and you just never know where he's going to go. You know, he's just such an amazing, he's like so avant-garde. I don't know why they call him classical. You know, he's playing blues, he's playing Jelly Roll blues, he's playing jazz, he's playing avant-garde, you know, he's outdoing Haydn and Mozart. I mean, he does bring a smile to my face, but I love early Beatles, and, you know, I like listening to the Mamas and Papas and early Janet Dean. I like listening to old 60s stuff.
Did you manage to save copies of all those records? I mean, at the time, did you accumulate every release that you had a cut on?
I did, but, you know, when I was ill, I threw everything away.
Oh.
I really wanted to get rid of P.F. Sloan, and I wanted to get rid of my music. So, you know, I threw everything in the trash. But fans, you know, really have saved my musical life. You know, fans found out about it and, you know, began sending me copies of everything that, so I pretty much have a really good library now of everything.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Of those,
it's really not my story, Michael. It's really the story of fans, because basically I'm a fan. You know, I've just been gifted with a talent, but to put me above a fan is not where I wanted to be. I'm just basically a fan of music, and it's the fans who took all the heat, you know.
Yeah,
for liking P.F. Sloan.
Interesting. Let's talk about, can you tell me maybe two or three or four songs that you wrote that were turning points throughout your career? Maybe Kick That Little Foot Sally Ann might be the first one. Songs that turned, you know, that you said, this is something new, you know, where you really discovered something in yourself that you didn't tap before.
Well, definitely Eve of Destruction, because it broke the mold of, you know, most pop songs had, you know, four lines and then a chorus. With Eve of Destruction, there were seven lines and then a chorus, and then three lines and a chorus, and then five lines and a chorus. Sins of a Family broke the mold as well. Secret Agent Man came out so smoothly that I was in awe at how well everything was sort of like a circular snake. You know, everything seemed to relate back to itself so well. You know, I mean, I think that's the beauty of a lot of Beatles songs as well, you know, and really great written songs, you know, that they're circular. You know, they're seamless. And it's an amazing feeling when you can write, when something like that comes out of you, that's seamless. You know, you look at it with awe and you go, my God, where did that come from?
Yeah. Tell me about the song In Celebration Of on the new album, My Beethoven. Tell me about that song.
When I was very, very ill and my mother bought me a $19 Casio, you know, one of the electronic keyboards, one of the very first ones.
Sure.
And, you know, it's just like, you know, the size of a bread box. And I would play two songs all the time, Long and Winding Road and A Whiter Shade of Pale. I mean, I would just play that for hours and hours and hours on the keyboard. Got a chance to meet Keith Reid in London during the Sailover tour. Keith gave me a lyric, and I was just in awe of Keith Reid because, you know, Whiter Shade of Pale, I thought, was one of the greatest songs ever written. And I made up my mind at that time that I'm going to write something with this lyric that will make Keith proud. And it took 9 years to write the melody and arrange it and everything like that. But that's the only song in the album that I didn't write the lyric on. That's Keith Reid from Procol Harum.
Wow, amazing. Well, we're going to hear that to end the show. I want to ask you, if you, next time you're in New York, if you can bring your guitar and come by the studio, we would love to have you. I think it would be just fascinating. I don't know if you're up for that, but...
Michael, I would love to. I would love to. All you have to do is ask.
Oh, well, next time you're in New York, it's an open invitation. I would just love to have you.
Fantastic.
So are you...
Yeah.
Are you happy? That's kind of the basic question.
You know, that is the real question, you know, and the answer is 1,000% yes. The spiritual training as a warrior that I've gone through being with Sai Baba over the last 27 years has taught me the purpose and meaning of life, and that the ups and downs of life just don't interfere with my happiness. It's all part of the play. Everything turns out for the best. It's all for the good.
All right. Well, it's absolutely fascinating. Thank you so much. I'm definitely going to get the book, of course, but I appreciate you taking your time for me this morning, and I'm glad we could finally connect. I think it was meant to be.
Yeah, I do, too. Michael, what a pleasure it is talking to you. Thank you, Michael.
Bye-bye.
I know a man who lives a lie. He's passing time until he dies. I know a man who stays at home. He's scared of ending up alone. I know a man who has great wealth. He only thinks about himself. And watch dogs become lap dogs. Nobody saves.